I'm not coming back for 30%. I'm coming back for everything.
You got into Harvard Law?
What, like it's hard?
Scarface on repeat. Scarface on repeat.
Constant, y'all.
Catch a painted pony on the spinning, 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 spinning wheel.
Some people are saying that your new music sounds a lot like Bob Dylan.
Well, maybe Bob Dylan sounds a lot like me.
She doesn't even go here. They knew, and they let it happen.
Oh, and in case I don't see you.
Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Indeed, 94.9 Radio Western. You are tuned in to Outside the Frame, London's only movie talk show. My name is Elijah.
Oh, I'm Mike.
I'm Sam.
Perfect. And we are Outside the Frame, London's only movie talk show. We talk about films and the culture that surround them. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Today's episode is going to be a lot of fun. But before I get into what the theme of today is, very quickly, if you want to take part in the conversation, you can text us 519-661-3600. That is 519-661-3600, as always. Just a fun time to be here. We are on Twitch. We're not streaming now, though, so no need to really bring that one up. But we do have movie trivia coming up next week, November 11th, at the Holy Diver from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. It's going to be a blast. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, and we're doing a little. Last month was obviously theme more towards horror. This time we're kind of going a little bit in a few different directions, which should be a lot of fun. And so it's not just, it should be a little bit more general knowledge of movies, but they are themed categories. So
yeah,
it's going to be so much fun. So that's November 11th, right?
That is correct.
Tuesday.
Tuesday, November 11th from 8 to 10 p.m.
To 10 p.m. We're going to have tons of awesome prizes as per usual.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's at the Holy Diver and it's going to be a lot of fun.
It's going to be a lot of fun. The past two have been a lot of fun, so I don't.
And we have a special guest.
We sure do. And it'll be the gentleman that is also joining us next week on our early Oscar predictions, and that would be Dalton Pike.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then
Dalton's going to follow us to trivia and help host trivia night. So
that is very true.
Yeah.
So looking forward to it. We're coming together with all the categories and I really think you're gonna like them. They're a lot of fun.
They're so much fun.
Yeah. You know what, I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to like the public. I think everybody is going to enjoy them. So make it on out. It's gonna be fun. Now we're in part four today of this series.
We're in the top 10 now.
We're in the top 10 of the top 25 movies of the past 25 years. It's we made it. It's been a long ride here from August, or I guess from July, since we initially put this this list together. And I'm just excited that we've got here, because every episode the stakes get risen.
Mm-hmm.
They get raised a little bit more and more each time, and it's a lot of fun to talk about these movies, and the movies just keep getting better. I mean, that's just by nature of how this list works.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, really trying to choose 25 movies in 25 for 25 years is crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was a crazy deliberation process of us just setting up in the newsroom over there.
Right.
Yeah.
You know what I thought might be a good way to start, just so we all know kind of where we're at.
Of course.
Here, let me just go through the films in order.
Oh, please.
Up to this point, and then we can kick it off with number 10. We're going from 10 today, which is crazy. Okay.
That's
25, we did The Grand Budapest Hotel. We had Mean Girls at 24, Avatar at 23, Little Women at 22. Right, Sam? Little Women?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Zero Dark Thirty. Oh, that movie rips. At 21. The Dark Knight at 20. American
rips.
Psycho at 19. Get Out at 18.
Rips.
No.
Yeah.
Lord of the Rings, Return of the King at 17. Lost in Translation at number 16.
Yeah.
Arrival. Dude, Lost in Translation is so awesome. Okay.
Okay.
Arrival at 15. WALL-E at 14.
Hell yeah.
The Wolf of Wall Street at 13. Spirited Away at 12. And I guess a Outside the Frame core text, if you will, which is Spotlight at number 11.
Indeed. Which is, you know what?
It's a pretty good list of movies.
Pretty solid list, I'd say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is very indicative of all of our tastes. You can tell it was put together by the four of us.
Yeah.
Because there are movies on there that I would never touch within, you know, with a 5-foot pole. Very similarly to you, Mike, and to Sam and to Ryan. So it's gonna be and you know what though? I think because we're in the top 10, these are essentially the unanimous ones. We're getting into territory where it's we all knew these 10 movies had to be on this list somewhere.
Yeah, 100%. Like, yeah, these are like I like that there's still like a couple of curveballs. You know what I mean? Like there's and we're going to get to maybe one today, which I'm very excited about. But there's still, you know, it's outside the frame. So we're going to throw some curveballs out there for you.
We have to.
Elijah, what's number 10?
Number 10 is a fun movie. Fun, depending on what your definition of the word fun is. But it is a movie that goes by the name of Whiplash.
No. Was I rushing or was I dragging?
Oh, no.
Count again.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Rushing
four.
Or dragging?
Rushing.
So you do know the difference. If you deliberately sabotage my band, I will f*** you like a pig. Now, are you a rusher or are you a dragger or are you going to be on my time?
I'm going to be on your time.
Oh my goodness. Whiplash is one hell of a movie. It was written and directed by Damien Chazelle, stars Miles Teller, J.K. Simmons, Paul Reiser, Melissa Benoist. It's about an ambitious jazz drummer, Teller, who is pushed to his limits by his abusive instructor to realize his full potential. This movie won 3 Oscars, including supporting actor, film editing, and sound mixing. It made $14 million domestically, $50 million worldwide. I'll pass this over to you, Mike. Why is this movie number 10 on our list?
Dude, well, there's a couple of things that surround this film. One, of course, is at the time, so this movie came out in 2014, and I can tell you that this iconic scene that you played as the introduction to this movie was spoofed, it was talked about, it was it was just one of those iconic scenes, and it is one of those iconic scenes in film.
Yes.
Even if you haven't seen the movie now, and maybe you're a little younger, you probably still know that scene in some way, shape, or form, because it just lives online, it lives in memes, it lives in all of these things, right? So I think that scene kind of just even was almost bigger than the film itself. Like, it was also kind of the perfect Oscar movie in a lot of ways, because a lot of times Oscar movies just don't make a lot of money. At least 10 years ago, that was the case. Now it's a little different. But yeah, I mean, you have, you know, Damien did a really smart thing in casting someone like J.K. Simmons, who he's the one that won the Oscar, by the way.
Right, right.
So you have that kind of energy and that experience coming on. And then you have an up and comer with Miles Teller, who took the role very seriously. And, you know, we didn't have the relationship we had with Damien Chazelle now.
No, this was his directorial debut.
Yes. And he did do it as a short first and then expanded it into the feature. But what I was saying is that music plays a huge role in not only the movie, but in Damien's movies. You know, the film, obviously, that that Sam can talk a lot about is La La Land, which, of course, music plays a huge role in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Babylon is a huge, like, musically driven film. He also works with a musician that like wrote a lot of the music in Whiplash and he's worked with before, like afterwards. He's in this category now. Chazelle is, I think, with the critical acclaim of Whiplash and then sort of the hugeness that was La La Land, as, you know, he's in that category with, you know, a Jordan Peele and a Greta Gerwig and that kind of a new up and coming class of filmmakers. And this was the first go. The energy of this movie it's weird, because if you look at it, like, you're like, what do you mean a jazz musician, like, band? Like, I'm telling you, this is an anxiety-inducing movie. It feels like it's paced so well, especially right up into the last scene, like the buildup of the whole movie to this iconic climax with this drum solo, and you know the hugeness of that moment for both characters, like, and the way that he just ends the movie also is just like, it's as they say, cinema. Like, it's just cinema.
Yeah.
And you could tell there was a lot of thought and care that was put into, like I said, the soundtrack, the performances, the way the script was written. That's why he was nominated for the script, because it is just so tight, and it pushes. Everything is just like this. One of my favorite scenes in the movie is the dinner scene.
That was all, I almost grabbed a quote from that one, actually.
It's really good. It's also weirdly rewatchable too. This movie, at least for me, it is.
I wouldn't even say weirdly. Yeah. It is super rewatchable because of the pacing that you mentioned.
Yeah.
There's a couple things I want to break down from what you mentioned. Mm-hmm. The first being, and I'll start by saying this: it was interesting that I had not known until I was doing research about this movie that it was produced by Blumhouse,
Jason Blum.
So mm-hmm. Blumhouse Productions.
Yeah.
Very known for their horror movies. You know, their Get Outs, their Sinisters.
But this is all before. Funny. This is before that, though. This is before Get Out.
Before Get Out, just after Sinister, I believe.
The first one, maybe?
Yes, the first one. Yeah. Which is funny because this movie is arguably more tense than a lot of their horror movies.
100%.
The tension that this movie builds in just not even using any, even though music plays a huge part in it, it really lets the performances pull on that tension, mm-hmm. especially from J.K. Simmons and the back and forth that him and Miles Teller have, especially at the beginning, when Miles Teller is more docile and mm-hmm. more vulnerable,
I think that's what makes the movie work so well, is that dynamic between the two of them. And essentially, this is a sports movie. That's what this movie is. It's just you substitute football or baseball or whatever with jazz drumming. and that's what this movie, I mean, because you see the character that J.K. Simmons is playing, like, represented in like almost every sports movie, abusive quote unquote coach that is pushing kids too hard and blah blah blah, right?
It's a general theme within movies in general, I guess, but sports movies about like what it means and what it takes to be the greatest or to be great. And so having please speak to it, Sam.
I had a note on that, and like there's this discussion of like how much suffering equals greatness.
Yes.
And there's like this sort of idea within all the characters' brains that you have to suffer so much and put yourself through so much in order to be the best. And and this movie sort of takes an interesting take on that.
Well,
is phenomenal at drumming.
Yes. But the idea is also that you can't necessarily do that on your own, that you need someone to essentially like break you down to like not even the most basic human, you know what I mean, and like break you down emotionally and stuff like that in order to you know build you into this machine, you know.
I think of
the Tom Brady thing that happened to him in Michigan. It's almost the same thing in a different way. Like, I'm not saying he had someone like Jake, a lot of it was self-imposed, but at the same time he had to go to a sport, like he went to sports psychologists, and they essentially said, like, you know, like he was at the bottom rung, like he was seventh on the depth charts at Michigan. He shouldn't be there. Basically, he's not great. Everyone else is better than him. It's the same thing in this movie. Like, you have four other drummers that's ahead of you. And what do you do? The thing that was what Brady was able to understand, which I feel like a lot of people kind of miss in sports, is that, I mean, we saw it this weekend with the Jays too, like these big moments, right? On the big stage, it's still, and it happens in Whiplash too. If you prepare, it's all about preparation, that that by nature, sports will give you an opportunity, and it's what you do with that opportunity, right? And so that was Brady's whole career. That's what happened to him at Michigan. It was like, you know, he was given just this little tiny opportunity, and what he treated it like it was the Super Bowl, right? And then all of a sudden he was like at, you know, at a Orange Bowl or whatever he was at, and he treated that like the Super Bowl. Then it's like every little thing. Then he gets to the Patriots and he's fourth on that depth chart. It's the same thing with Miles Teller's character. It was like he had to treat those practices like he was on the biggest stage, right? Now, the interesting thing about the suffering is like, do you need that externalness of,
right,
and that abusiveness, that negative, that, like, I mean, barrage of insanity, you know, to make you realize these things and make you push yourself further and,
yes,
and make you better.
Yes.
You know?
And I love that the movie, especially the ending, I think it's honestly one of my, if not my favorite ending of any of the movies on our list,
because it's really good.
It doesn't really give you, it doesn't really give you an answer. It actually lets you decide, or the audience decide, whether or not what has happened is, you know, depends on your framing.
100%.
It's like, wow, he has truly achieved greatness through the beating down of this, like, psychopath.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you see his father's look at him, and is it a shock and awe, or is it, oh, my son is lost now?
Yeah.
You know, for what? He's pushed away his girlfriend, he's pushed away his family, and he's fallen into the mindset of this psychopath. Like, it really lets you decide.
Well, as Sam was saying, like, the question is then, was that suffering worth it?
Right. Right.
That's really what the question is at the end.
Yeah.
Like he does the thing.
Yep.
Right. He does the thing. And so you're left with that question. Was all of that worth it? Was the suffering worth it? Right.
Yes. Yeah. Just masterfully done in both of in all of those ways. I don't really have a lot more to say about this. I think that J.K. Simmons gives an all-timer performance.
It's a five-star.
It's like, not like we haven't seen like a drill sergeant-esque performance before, but he is so commanding.
Mm-hmm.
His performance is so commanding. And in any other, and, you know, paired with smart writing, it lets you, you know, be captivated by his performance rather than just being like, oh, this guy's a psychopath. Like he's, we actually kind of see why he is the way he is and what his nature is derived from.
My favorite thing, and maybe this is why I connect with this movie, not just from the musical standpoint, but is that I love that it's such a niche thing that they take so seriously. Like an example on is, you know, you said drill sergeant. So, okay, Full Metal Jacket.
Right.
Okay, well, the stakes are about as high as you can get. Like, this guy's basically like, if you don't listen to me, you're going to die, essentially, mm-hmm, right? So, therefore, I'm going to treat you like this so that I can build you up to be a person that doesn't die or has a less chance of dying, right? Stakes are at all-time high. If you look at sports movies, it's like, you know, the championship game, the whatever. And we're talking about, like, American sports or North American sports or whatever, soccer, the biggest things that you can do, right, in sports. Here we're talking about jazz drumming, okay?
Right.
Right. First of all, it's like a niche of a niche genre of music, right?
Yep.
And then you're talking about someone who plays that music on one specific instrument.
And is classically trained to play that. Yeah.
Right. And it's like, well, that's his Super Bowl. That's his, mm-hmm, you know, World War II, right? But the way that J.K. Simmons, like his character, treats it is like, it is World War II.
It's life or death.
It is life or death, right? And if you don't treat it like that too, then we have nothing to, like, nothing else matters.
You're wasting our time, yeah.
And that's something that I connect with so much because, like, jazz and jazz drumming is very dumb. So are movies. It's all very stupid. However, to me, like, someone might be like, yeah, but jazz drumming is the most important thing to me, right?
Right.
In my case, mm-hmm, it's movies are the most important thing. It's also very stupid, though. It's very dumb to care about opinions about movies and rank them and say that you're a dumb person for not liking the movie this way. Like, it's very, and like analyzing movies and thinking that they matter on this level. Because they do at the same time. It is all very dumb. But that's what I connect with, is that, like, I also take it very seriously. When you're making a film, it is life or death. It is, like, in a lot of cases, it is. It's financial life or death. It's career life or death. Like, it's very serious. But you're just doing it in a thing that's kind of really dumb. It doesn't mean much, you know? And I love that. You know?
Yeah.
Hello?
Are you there?
Hello? I love that you brought that up. Oh my God. Okay. I love that you brought that up, because I think that's the thing that makes this, that's like the one thing that makes, or the one of the few things that makes this movie so relatable, and why I love this kind of genre of movie. Because, like, whenever I think of this movie, I also kind of think of Black Swan and how she's.
Oh, dude. See, exactly. Very similar. Yes.
Destroying herself for this craft or this art that she just loves. And I think everyone, a lot of people at least, have one thing that they absolutely would just destroy themselves for.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the one thing that makes this movie so addictive, almost, is that, like, yeah, like, he has to be great. And you feel like, yeah, you know, like, I get why he wants it so bad.
Yeah.
But at the same time, at what cost?
Everybody has their passion, right? So it's just about what you do to dedicate yourself to being the best at that.
It's not a passion, though.
But
it's not.
Jazz drumming is absolutely a passion.
It's an obsession.
Oh, fair point. Right? Okay. But that's where it gets interesting. It's where it becomes the rest of them being passionate.
You can have a passion for ice cream.
Obsessed with it, you know?
where it gets interesting is if you're obsessed with ice cream.
Right. Exactly. And that's where the movie kind of lets you decide where's the line.
Yes.
And where does that line get crossed?
Yeah.
Do we have any final thoughts before we move on to our number 9 pick?
Go for it.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, our number 9 pick is a gorgeous, gorgeous little movie that goes by the name of Moonlight.
That's what I gonna call you. Blue.
Say your name, Blue.
Nah. At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you want. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
Moonlight, written and directed by Barry Jenkins. It's an adaptation of the unpublished play In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue by Terrell Alvin McCraney. This movie stars Mahershala Ali, Trevante Rhodes, Alex R. Hibbert, Ashton Sanders, Janelle Monáe, Naomi Harris, amongst others. And it's about a young black boy's life played out in three stages: child, adolescence, and adulthood, as he grapples with his identity and sexuality growing up in Liberty City, Florida. This movie won 3 Oscars, including Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Supporting Actor, and of course, Best Picture. This movie made $27 million domestically and $66 million worldwide. Why is this on our list? Well, let me set the scene for you.
All my research on this, I thought we were doing Mufasa, The Lion King, the other Barry Jenkins movie.
The most recent one?
Yeah.
I know it was close to getting on our list, but I know we have to choose one, and, you know, this one is, it just edges out Mufasa, the prequel.
I mean, get paid for sure, but what do you do? What's it?
As long as his next movie is okay. Like, as long as his next movie is an original one, like, you know.
It's not even about, dude, Mufasa, The Lion King, dude?
It made hella bank. It made bank.
That's what I'm saying. Like, get paid. Like, I understand. But also, like, dude, you made Moonlight.
You made Moonlight.
Like, what are you doing?
You made Moonlight.
Yeah. Like, what are you doing?
The Best Picture winner, which is an interesting follow-up to the movie that we just talked about. Because at the Academy Awards of the year of 2017, there was 2 movies that were up and were highly anticipated to be the winners of Best Picture. Damien Chazelle had just won Best Director for La La Land, and it was time to announce the winner for Best Picture. And lo and behold, La La Land was announced. The producers, the cast, everybody went up.
Excited.
Everyone was very excited.
Sam, I'm sure, was pumped. I was like, ugh.
I was also quite infuriated by it. But things kind of turned my way all of the sudden, one of the producers for La La Land said, there's been a mistake. I'm sorry, there has been a mistake. Moonlight, you actually won. He turns the card to the camera. The camera zooms in and shows Moonlight is the winner of Best Picture. And in one of the most confusing moments in TV history,
Oscar history,
award show history.
Yes. Yeah.
They all have to awkwardly get off the stage while Moonlight cast and producers get on the stage.
Yeah.
And it made history for a movie, which is such a weird thing that it was such a huge, huge deal for such a small movie. This movie already, I think adjusted for inflation, this movie actually has the smallest budget of any Best Picture winner. The only one that can compete is the original Rocky.
Well, I mean, probably Whiplash would be up there too.
It would be up there, Whiplash.
It didn't win though. But I'm just saying,
right?
Of
Best Picture winners.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Rocky is the only one, but it was 1.1 million, like what, 50 years ago or something like that.
76.
Yeah. So this made on a $1.5 million budget.
That's so crazy.
Crazy that they could make this movie look as gorgeous as it does, sound as gorgeous as it does, acted and get the talent that went into this movie.
Guaranteed that's what was spent on coffee alone on Mufasa the Lion King.
Easily.
Yeah.
This movie, I was taking a look at the list, and I think that this is probably the most quiet and most vulnerable movie on our list. I can't really think of one that is as, we have some character studies on here, but none that are this central. Yeah. This movie has a very complex way of looking at masculinity and what masculinity looks like, not just as a black man, not just as a gay man, but just men in general. It shows what happens when you get vulnerability versus aggression, and how aggression can so often look like masculinity, and what happens when you are encountering somebody who doesn't necessarily have that hyper-masculine approach to them. I think that there's so much about this movie. Obviously, it tackles a lot of that. There's a lot of intersectionality with this movie. I think one of my favorite parts about this movie, I know I just detailed what, you know, masculinity looks like, but what the role model in somebody's life can look like. This movie takes an interesting approach to that with the character of Juan, played by Mahershala Ali, who, you know, in any other movie, or in a much more cliched version of Moonlight, you know, the drug dealer who takes the little kid under his wing and you know, tries to steer him clear and is in his protector, right, is the guy who raises him. But the writing and that Barry Jenkins utilizes to make it so that Juan is actually not only his role model and his protector, but is also one of the main reasons why he's growing up the way he is, selling his mother drugs. Just a fascinating look and turns that entire dynamic on its head. Mm-hmm. I think that this movie has really clever ways and really brilliant ways to take something that we've already seen and just kind of,
well, it's also told in a somewhat interesting way. Like, mm-hmm. It's not just like you could rearrange that movie and retell that movie so that it's more no shade to this film, but like more like Boys in the Hood or right. something, where it's like more of a straight up, like sort of, you know, kind of Hollywood, quote unquote, narrative. Mm-hmm. But this is like indie filmmaking, like 101. Like, we're going to take a story and characters that you kind of understand in a way through film, mm-hmm. and we're going to recontextualize it, and we're going to rewrap it, and we're going to tell it in a different way. You know, like, but this is what Pulp Fiction did too. You know what I mean? Like,
100%.
In the sense of, we're going to take all these tropes and stereotypes that you know, and we're going to rewrap it,
yeah, right?
So that you look at it differently. And that's, you know, that I think that's what you're kind of alluding to with the idea of masculinity too, mm-hmm. like the themes of this movie. But yeah, the way that it's told is really, and you have to do those things when you have like no money and
right,
you know, you're trying to get this movie out there. And you know, I mean, Damien had already went through that with Whiplash, so by the time he gets to La La Land, he had a lot more toys, you know, so that mm-hmm. movie looks and is on the technical level on a totally different, that is
very
much,
grand.
That's much more your sort of, you know, Hollywood narrative. You know, it is a little bit of an odd film for sure. But in terms of its, you know, the way that it's shot and the actors, I mean, he has Emma Stone and Gosling.
Yeah.
Gosling, sorry. This movie is just, again, it's like the little film that could, you know?
Is why it was so interesting when these two went up against each other.
Yeah.
Because it could not be more of a David and Goliath, story. Yeah. That somehow David was able to overcome.
Yeah.
I like what you mentioned about it being recontextualized, because this is like masculinity is not something that's it's not foreign to storytelling or to film by any means.
No, but it misses a lot of nuance though. And also I think, not to get into a whole other realm, but that's where I think a lot of the misunderstanding of what male/masculinity and sexuality, all of that stuff that goes along with it, a lot of it is looked through the lens of like a 14-year-old boy, and that's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. And it can't ever be anything more than that.
Right.
And where the opposite is much more complex, and it's much more of a mystery and blah, blah, blah. Right.
For sure.
And I don't mean to blah, blah, blah it, but I just mean like, there's a lot more to that where, you know, this film attempts to, and I think successfully, gives us much more nuance and a different understanding of what that could look like, right?
And not just in the settings that it is or the in terms of, you know, race or sexual identity, but also the fact that this movie takes place at three separate stages of his life.
Correct.
So it shows you the initial feelings that he has of growing up and feeling different than everybody else when he's a child. How when he kind of confirms that in his teenagehood and his adolescence, what that does to him and who turns against him because of it. And then in his adult life, how that has all played out to shape him to who he is now, where he's kind of repressed that to now he has to put up a front to who he, you know, a completely different person, to more in line with the people that bullied him as a kid rather than, you know, being closer to his true self.
Yeah, I really like the way that you said that. I think that, it showed so well, because like when you're a kid, this character is so good, and he's a sweet, sweet character. And then, when you're a kid, you kind of just like look to other people to show you who you are, and you can see the emotional weight that every single character has on him from a very young age, and how that like carries throughout the movie. And not a lot of movies do that, where you can literally see every single character's effect on this person.
Yeah, you see the actions through his own the more he grows up. You know, you see how Juan's character was influenced in him and how he's kind of taken some of those traits and brought them into his adult life, or how the kindness of, I'm forgetting her name, but Janelle Monáe's character, mm-hmm. how he interprets that into his adolescence. Very well done. And I think it's interesting to note that during my research, I read that the actors playing the three versions of Chiron did not meet each other at any point during this and had no idea what the other interpretation was going to be. But I think that speaks a lot to the direction that Barry Jenkins gave them all, that there is subtle hints of each other's performances in each other that you can spot almost instantly. I just think that that's so masterful. It's a small movie, as we mentioned, but I think it's lit gorgeously. I think it's acted gorgeously. I think it's written gorgeously. The needle drops also are fantastic. I could talk for literally hours about how great the needle drops are in this movie and why they mean so much to the movie. But I just think that this is truly one of the best movies of the past 25 years, and it had to make this list. It was the one that I...
ride or die.
Was ride or die. There were certain ones that we all had to make this list. This was one that had to make this list. And I'm so glad it made it to the top 10.
Top 10, baby.
Top 10. So when we get back, we will, from these breaks, because that's what we're going to do. We're going to cut to some commercial breaks, and we're going to get into our number 8 pick on our top 25 movies of the past 25 years. Don't go anywhere. We will be right back with more Outside the Frame. Keep it locked. If you're just tuning in, thank you. You're listening to 94.9 Radio Western. You're specifically listening to Outside the Frame, London's only movie talk show. We are currently in the midst of our part four of our top 25 films of the past 25 years. We just got finished talking about Whiplash and Moonlight. And now we are on to our number eight pick, which is also a bit of a quiet movie, but takes it in a much weirder direction, I would say. And that would be the film Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Was it something I said?
Yeah. You said so go. With such disdain, you know?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Jolie? What if you stay this time?
I walked out the door. There's no memory left.
Come back and make up a goodbye, at least. Let's pretend we have one.
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. This movie, of course, was directed by Michael Gondry. It was written
Michel.
By... Is it Michel?
Michel Gondry.
My apologies. Oh, yeah, he's French. That's right. My apologies. It was directed by Michel Gondry, also written by him and Charlie Kaufman and Pierre Bismuth. I'm going to assume that's how that's pronounced. Stars Jim Carrey, Kate Winslet, Kirsten Dunst, Mark Ruffalo, Elijah Wood, Tom Wilkinson, David Cross, amongst some others. And it's about a couple who undergo a medical procedure to have each other erased from their respective memories after their relationship falls apart. This movie won one Oscar for Best Original Screenplay and was also nominated for Kate Winslet was nominated for Best Actress. Made $34 million domestically, $73 million worldwide. I'm going to pass this one off to Sam first. Sam, why is this movie number eight on our top 25 list?
Oh my gosh. Okay. I think that it literally, if I did nothing in my life and I only did one thing and it was create this movie, I would be so insanely proud. I think that this movie talks about just human connection in a way that's so, like, I've heard so many people say that this movie is simple, but I think the way that it talks about people and their relationships is really complex. And I think that when you're watching that movie, it really just sticks with you. Like, geez. And it's such an interesting spin on a relationship and saying, yeah, like, yeah, it did suck, but here's, you know, what else? What else would it be?
Yeah, it's the ultimate. Is it better to love and lost or to have never loved at all? Movie, the ultimate breakup movie, the ultimate movie about, you know, just losing that love and just trying to hold on. What you have when that love is gone are the memories that you have that are associated with it, no matter how hard they hurt. Honestly, one of the best premises of any movie on our list, like truly an astounding premise.
It's so brilliant. Yeah.
That had me hooked from the jump.
Well, here's the thing that Sam mentioned, okay, that I want to touch on, which is the creativity behind this movie. Now, number one, Charlie Kaufman wrote this movie. The other two guys just helped with the story. This is a Charlie Kaufman screenplay. That's who's nominated. That's where all this weirdness is coming from.
Right.
It's not coming from anyone else. Okay. If you don't know who Charlie Kaufman is, I would highly, highly recommend looking into him. He does some great public speaking sort of talks and on writing and his process, which sounds gross, but it's not when it's coming from him. He's extremely self-deprecating. So that's why when Sam was like, I'd be so proud of it. Like if he was here, he would shrink into a little corner. Like he is like just the definition of a person who is so self-aware and so self what's the word I'm looking for self-analytical to the point where it's like a problem.
right
and so that's it makes me happy knowing a little bit about his history, where he comes from, being a fan of his work specifically, to that this movie, it's not just We're just obviously three people, but it's a lot of other people connect with this film, not knowing who Gondry is, not knowing who Charlie Kaufman is, not knowing anything about that, and just seeing it as this sort of creative, wild, like, who even did a person come up with this movie? Like, where did this come from, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the most fascinating things about Kaufman is, like, when you look, I mean, the best way to get into the space of this movie is knowing that he wrote a movie called Being John Malkovich.
Okay? Oh, hell yeah.
And this is, I'm just gonna just let me cook here for 30 seconds. This is a movie in which John Cusack goes into this job where, like, all the the ceilings are, like, descending into this, like, really small kind of office space. And you're like, what is happening? And he figures out that if you go through this one tunnel or this one air duct or whatever, that you get to live inside of the real actor, John Malkovich's brain. You get to see what he's seeing, right? And inside of his head for 15 minutes. And then after the 15 minutes are up, you're spit out on the edge of a New Jersey turnpike.
Yes.
That's the premise of this movie. That's what this movie is. He starts selling tickets, right? Then that's only the first half of the movie. Then it becomes this whole existential crisis movie and all this other craziness happens.
Yeah.
That is the man. That is the person that wrote that movie, okay, is writing. This is his version of Love Actually. Okay, this is his version of
if he was given a storyline.
When Harry Met Sally. No, this is his romantic comedy, right? Is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Would you frame this as a romantic comedy?
Absolutely not. But I'm saying this is
if he was asked
that's this person's
write a romantic
version,
comedy.
Right.
He'd be like,
This is it, right? This is you're falling in love with someone, right? Is it better to have love and loss, right? These are all things that are inside of When Harry Met Sally.
I'd love to see that.
Except in this movie, you have all this other insanity happening, right?
Right.
It is essentially a rom-com. This movie is.
It is very romantic.
However, it's coming from, that's where this is coming from, is like the swirling person of insanity, right, and creativity and self-deprecation, so self-analytical that it's like a disease almost, right? Mm-hmm. Can even you find a person to fall in love with, or that will fall in love with me? And what would it would take time travel and all this other stuff to, like, right? And then are you going to self sabotage it, or are you gonna ruin it? Are you gonna, you know? He's asking all of these kind of questions, and yeah, it's basically like write me When Harry Met Sally, and then he drops you the script to
Eternal Sunshine
of the Spotless Mind. Yeah,
he's never written a straightforward movie in his life, and I'm so thankful that we have him.
He's one of one.
And it's interesting that this ends up becoming his most popular movie, and his most accessible, because even at his most accessible, it is still quite a weird movie.
Mm-hmm. It's very weird.
Very weird. Like, again, the concept could have been pretty straightforward in anybody else's hands, but he has a way to elevate this material by putting his own original kind of twisted twist on it.
Yes. So let me ask you guys this. What was your introduction to this movie? Like, how did you, like, did you just randomly see it somewhere? Like, how, like, what was your introduction to this film? How were you introduced to it?
I'll let you go first, Sam.
Oh, I think I thought this movie and Requiem for a Dream were, like, the same movie.
Wow.
So then at one point I was like, I think I should watch at least one of them just to, like, be able to differentiate them. And so I kind of just, like, threw it on, not really thinking. And I was like, this is actually unbelievable. This is so good.
Brother, how old were you when this happened?
Well, first of all,
I think this was three years ago.
I was going to say, because Requiem for a Dream, you were probably 6 months old when it came out. And then you were probably, what, two when Eternal Sunshine came out? I don't know.
Two or three, I would assume, yeah.
Pretty young. Yeah.
I'm glad you chose to watch this one. because I think
it's the same movie, dude. That's so crazy. That's amazing.
They are both about love in certain ways.
In certain ways.
Yeah, one is just a love of like one's like the sub like you know the you know drug gives you a drugs give you that euphoric feeling, and one love gives you that euphoric feeling. Yeah, so,
For me, it was Poison because this was like one of the coolest films to come out. This was a very cool movie. If someone you know mentioned, oh, have you seen? Do you know of this movie? You're like, oh, this person's like really into.
They know ball. Yeah,
yeah, they're into movies, right? and no one, ball. It's true though. Yeah. But this movie has actually a fantastic. I almost swore there. A fantastic soundtrack.
It does,
and it has a great cover of. I think it's a cover of ELO's. Mr. Blue Sky. I can't remember if they used the original or if it was a cover. Anyways, it's awesome. And I believe that's how I was introduced to the movie was through the soundtrack first.
Very nice.
I was like, oh, this is great. And then I watched the movie. And I was like, I don't understand this at all as a 17-year-old.
Yeah.
I was introduced to it by a person who was fancied themselves like a cinema person.
A cinephile.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what about you?
I loved Jim Carrey. And so I was 10 when I watched this movie.
Sure. That's way too young.
I had no idea. I didn't even know. I didn't know the word love, let alone what it's like to feel it, what it's like to lose it.
Yeah.
And then eventually when I became, you know, more
a person
and more online and more myself, and I actually had run-ins with love and what that means and what it's like to lose love.
Run-ins. Like,
yeah. Like, no, genuinely. Like, I actually got, the shit kicked out of me by love. Then, you know, I was, like, I was going through breakup movies, and so I looked at this one, and let me try this, because here's the thing, and I want to defend this movie because it kind of got a reputation at one point as being, like, the hipster go-to movie what's your favorite movie? Yeah. And it's I'm a cinephile, so I like Eternal Sunshine.
Eternal Sunshine.
Just Kaufman's, like, his auteurism is just, you know, it's like, but this just happens to be
Michel's
the case.
Gondry.
You're not rolling your tongue enough with it. It's just the rare case where it is probably the go-to for most hipsters, but it genuinely is just a fantastic movie. So I decided to go back and watch it. And was floored, like truly floored by the craftsmanship, by the performances. Another time that Jim Carrey was just like completely overlooked, and just not even they did not even give him a second glance at an Academy Award. Again,
so this is post. I believe he does this. I feel like it's right after. You'd have to IMDb it, but I'm pretty sure it's right after he does. The Christmas movie, How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
This is about 2 years after that, I believe. Yeah.
So he made, there might have been The Majestic in there.
Yep, The Majestic was in there. The Truman Show was just before that.
Truman Show's 97 or 98.
That was 99.
No, it's before Survivor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
And
okay.
It's before the reality TV
the boom. Yeah.
I think it's 97 or 98.
Okay.
Anyway, so this is when he was trying to get out. He just had one of the most all-time runs of ever in the history of actors, 7-8 years where he was every movie made $400 million, but they were, you know, Dumb and Dumber and Ace Ventura
and the mask, silly.
And the Truman Show obviously did very well, but that was kind of one of the most perfect roles for him, because he was could be the person that everyone thought he was, but also could kind of stretch his acting chops. This is where he's going into a different space.
Because he did the Truman Show, then he did Man on the Moon, then he did The Majestic, and then he did this one.
And Grinch was in there.
The Grinch was in there too, which is silly, but just a transformative role.
So good.
Yeah. I was watching all of his movies at the time, and that's kind of how I stumbled upon this one.
Follow-up to Being John Malkovich was adaptation I with your boy
Nick Cage,
who's actually dual role in that.
Yep.
And they actually call back to Being John Malkovich in that movie. It is meta before, like, this is post-Scream. This really solidifies the idea of, like, literally it's a guy who's playing, like, Charlie Kaufman writing the next script after he wrote Being John Malkovich, but, like, based on a book, but he can't write the book. Like, it is like four levels deep of like what meta is, you know. And so he does that movie. I wanted to shout out that one of his more recent films, this is Charlie Kaufman, by the way, one of his more recent films that he did that I really liked was I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
That's right.
A favorite
of Sam's.
Which is a very bizarre film, but very good. Also kind of a romance movie, but in a very bizarre way. So anyway,
any final thoughts on this movie before we move on to our number seven?
This movie's awesome.
Yeah.
Kaufman's awesome.
I actually had one small thing.
Okay.
I liked what you were saying earlier about how, like, this thing, this, like the losing people happens to everyone. And I wanted to say that I like that this movie feels so tangible. Like, it doesn't feel like super high quality Marvel out of this world. It feels like this could happen to your neighbor.
For sure.
Even if it has like wild concepts in it, it's still very grounded, I think is a good word for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Because I 100% agree with you.
Everybody can relate to a movie like this, even though it's execution, which I think is like something I really look for in movies, is something that can be very inventive, very innovative, very high concept, but brought down to a level that is very, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Accessible.
Yeah.
You know, because anybody can access their emotions and their feelings of this and find some relation.
It lives in this weird spot of it feels like a first time, not a first time, but like a really small independent film.
Yeah.
But it's also Charlie Kaufman's like third or fourth movie,
starring Jim Carrey
and Kate Winslet. Like,
Elijah Wood, in the midst of Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, and you're like, how is this movie? Like, it feels like it was made for like $500,000, and like also directed by Michel Gondry.
Yeah. This movie's awesome.
Yeah,
This movie's great.
It's great.
And we move from a very nice, soft, loving movie to just a hardcore, hardcore emphasis on hard sexual movie. And that would be a banger of a movie called The Handmaiden.
백장님이 오늘? 그래서 그렇게 목욕하러 사셨구나.
저희 이모는요, 손님 오신다고 하면 먹던 숟가락도 놓고 애기씨를 씻겼대요. 손님이 애기한테서 좋은 냄새 난다고 그럴 때가 제일로 기뻤거든요. 아가씨는 제 애기 씻으세요. 이모가 애기 씻길 때 사탕을 물리거든요. 목욕이 얼마나 달콤한지 가르쳐준다고. 왜 그러세요?
The Handmaiden.
Yeah,
oh my goodness. Directed and written by none other than Park Chan-wook. Yeah. Also written by him, Chung Seo-kyun and Sarah Waters. This movie stars Kim Tae-ri, Lee Young-yo, and Yao Min-che. And it's about a pickpocket who is hired as a handmaiden by a swindler to help seduce and steal the fortune of a Japanese heiress. That is the most basic and vague way I can give that to you, but I think it's the best way anybody could go into this movie. It made $2 million domestically, $37 million worldwide. Why is this movie on our top 10? Because it rips. It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's hell of a ride.
It's a masterpiece. And Park Chan-wook, who also has a movie coming out shortly called No Other Choice. This to me is everything that his career was pushing towards. It looks amazing. The cinematography's wonderful, gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Performance is amazing. The writing, the way that his stories have always been like this, where they are always onions, you know, they're peeling layers back, and revealing different things as the, and it's not just a twist. It's
like an unveiling. Yeah.
And it keeps unveiling. And that's what this story is. That's mm-hmm. why like that premise or like the little like sort of introduction there is like, yeah, I mean, that's, I guess the setup of one character. Sure. Or like,
yeah, right? That's what you're given going into it. Yeah.
And it just gets into all these different kind of spaces where you didn't think the story was going to go.
Yeah.
And that's why, like this movie, like I said, he's one of the living masters of filmmaking. This to me is the best example of that. Some people might put put Old Boy up there. They might put a few other of his other films up there. For me, it is this one. It is the most Park Chan-wook movie. It is sexual. It is violent. It is disturbing. It is gorgeous, beautiful. All the things that to me make him one of my personal favorite filmmakers.
Yeah.
Of course, as you can tell, this is a movie that I have a couple of, like, you know, I think we each had one or two movies that we were riding and dying for. This was one of them for me. And I was like, this has to be on there somewhere.
Yeah.
It's everything that I want in a movie too, in terms of like the psychology of characters and the psychology of humans and what we, you know, our desires, our obsessions,
yeah,
what we want, love, you know, again, sex, lust, all of those things.
Yes.
It's just all wrapped up into this one epic tale.
Also love a good movie where you know, power dynamics might be twisted, but somebody who thinks that they have the upper hand,
they
just
don't.
Gets their comeuppance.
Yeah, love a good comeuppance, dude.
And it's fantastic. Yeah. I love what this movie does with what it says about sex and how it uses sex to its advantage and how the different characters utilize this to their advantage.
Yeah.
And how, again, I just said it, but because I don't want to give too much away, but how so many people think because they can do something, they have the upper hand.
That's right.
Just to figure out that they're being outplayed the whole time.
It's class. It's also like in terms of the different class structures. It's all of these things. This to me is a absolute no doubter 5-star. Like, can't have it on, you know, if you're making a list and this isn't on it. And you call yourself a movie fan or a cinephile or whatever, it's hard for me to look past that, you know.
Poster, by the way.
The poster, everything.
Poster's fantastic.
Yeah, it's so pretty.
Yeah,
everything about this movie is like, is just incredible. Like the, like it's, yeah, it's like a, it looks like a, you know, someone took this like historic, almost like 50s or 60s style, you know, Asian film, but then inserted like depravity and and as you were saying, the power dynamics and class, the class dynamics and all of these things, and inserted into like some sort of, you know, historical epic, like I said, from like the 50s.
Yeah. Like, another thing about this movie that I guess sort of touches on everything you guys were saying is that it's like fun being an audience member.
Oh, dude.
Because like, you're so disoriented and it's like a puzzle and you're like trying to and you like think one thing about a character and then that flips and then it goes back to it.
Yep.
And it's literally like you're putting pieces together as you're watching it and like you're,
I mean,
like,
you just nailed, you nailed it.
Your head.
You nailed it, Sam. It's, and that's what movies are supposed to do, really, is like, it should be fun being an audience member.
Such a fun watch.
You know, this movie is what I call a full meal. This is a full meal movie. This is, you know, this isn't candy. It's not, you know, it's not one thing. There's dessert in it for sure, but there's also an appetizer. Mm. There's a full meal. There's your main course. It is everything. This is a full meal movie. Like when you get through it, you're like, okay, you know,
I am satisfied.
That's
yeah.
right. This is a, and like Sam was saying, I mean, she just nailed it. Like, you know, it is so much fun being an audience member and rewatching this movie because you forget all these little details about like, oh yeah, like that's why. Oh, right. Because it is so dense, the unveiling of these different elements of the story. So you'll forget different details. So,
yeah,
it's always a fun rewatch too.
It really is. If you have not seen this movie, I couldn't suggest it more. It's fantastic. Any more?
Be warned.
Be warned. Yeah, don't watch it. Don't watch it with the family.
Yeah, it's not.
This is a you alone type movie, or like you and your friends. Yeah. This is like you and your close friends if you're going to, or just by yourself. Yeah.
And look at the time. And our last film is that. And we'll see you guys next week. See you later.
To Mike's huge dismay, we have one more movie to get through. Although we do have to get through it quite quickly, which is
goodbye.
Yeah. Much to your enlightenment. This would be
elation.
Thank you. That's the word. That would be the number 6 movie on our list. That would be No Country for Old Men.
What's the most you ever lost on a coin toss?
Sir?
The most you ever lost on a coin toss?
I don't know. I couldn't say.
Call it.
Call it.
Yes.
For what?
Just call it.
Well, we need to know what we're calling it for here.
You need to call it. I can't call it for you. Well, it wouldn't be fair.
I didn't put nothing up.
Yes, you did. You've been putting it up your whole life. You just didn't know it.
That would be No Country for Old Men, written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, adaptation of the Cormac McCarthy novel. Stars, of course, Josh Brolin, Javier Bardem, Woody Harrelson, Tommy Lee Jones, Kelly MacDonald. It's about a hunter who stumbles upon $2 million after a drug deal gone wrong, and he finds himself in the sights of a hitman who is hired to retrieve the money.
Blah, blue, blah, blue.
This won 4 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor, Best Director, and Best Adapted Screenplay. $74 million domestic, $171 million worldwide.
Crazy.
I have some notes from someone who couldn't be here today, who is largely the reason this movie is so high up on our list.
Well, that's how we'll probably end things. I will say, like, there is some, almost every movie, if not every movie on the top 10 has these like iconic moments,
right?
And the scene that you played there, I mean, I was in film school when this was released. I mean, that the coin flip scene was just, it's an iconic scene, right?
It is.
And it's an iconic scene in cinema, in pop culture. It was a moment. That was definitely a moment. It
for
makes
sure.
it even stronger that, you know, they were shooting concurrently with There Will Be Blood and the whole PTA Cohen thing and the Oscar race and 2007 being such a big year for movies and this iconic year. So, you know, yeah, this movie has to be.
I don't want to downplay this movie. Yeah. I just don't think if it was the three of us, I just don't think it would be as high on the list.
It wouldn't be.
I still think it deserves to make the list.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, of course.
All of us.
I think. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. With that being said, the person that I got notes from said that basically the entire movie has no score, is entirely silent, but you don't notice because of the intensity of the interactions. This person believes that it is a perfect translation of the Cormac McCarthy novel.
Mm-hmm.
The Coen brothers at one of their many peaks, and loves how much this ties into the title of No Country for Old Men, being the fact that Tommy Lee Jones plays an old guard who can't understand and grasp why his viewpoints and his morals don't belong. In this modern world. This movie has an incredible Javier Bardem performance. I really like his performance in this.
He's still chasing it.
Yeah, like that's the thing, is once you give one this good, it's hard to top it. Yeah,
yeah,
hard to top it. But I mean, he got almost every award in the book for it.
It's the haircut, man.
The haircut really makes him freaky. This brought a whole new revitalization to the Western genre in modern times. Obviously, after like the 90s, there was kind of slowed down a bit, but then mid to end 2000s, this is kind of what shot new life into it.
This movie is, I mean, maybe Sam can speak on it a little more, but like, this is like core, like film bro.
For sure.
And I think, I was 22 when this came out. I was in film school. So you can imagine what the hype and what was happening when this movie came out and how many times people were going to see it and how many people tried to emulate what was happening and the talk about it. And I will say, like, you guys know me a little bit, listeners of the show. If you listen more than like once, you'll kind of get a sense of who I am. If something's like super populist for what I think is like shallow reasons, even reasons that I don't even understand, I will just immediately go against it just because I'm not that kind of person. Like, I have to like it for my own reasons.
Of course.
If it's popular, great. If it's not, I don't I don't give a shit. So, but with this movie, it was like, it felt like it, it was why it took me a much longer to come around to the Tarantino thing too, because it was just so forced down your throat. Like, you must think this is brilliant.
Everybody was talking about it. Everyone was talking about what a masterpiece it was.
Being in film school,
I can only imagine.
It was so, like, everyone was just like, look at the cinematography. God. And I'm like, hey, you know what's really cool? Like, Russ Meyer. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I want to be doing. And then they're talking about all the violence in the movie. I was like, this is crap. You know what I mean? Like, this is
it must have been,
this is high, this is like the this is wine sipper crap. You know what I mean? Like,
it would have been real fun to be a woman in film school in 2007 when this and There Will Be Blood came out.
I can tell you, it's one of the reasons why I think I got along with a lot of my classmates that were female, because I was like, I was just ripping this There Will Be Blood. I was just like, this is all like pretentious BS. Like, I'm not in, this is not what I'm into. You know,
right.
What I mean? It's not what I wanted to make. It's not the filmmakers I was into. Obviously, as you get older, you develop taste and you develop, you know, or you should anyway. And you can kind of see things beside just your own, what you like versus, you know, what makes something good and what that is. And, you know, for me, I'll say I'll take, you know, personally, I like There Will Be Blood better as a movie if we were to. But on top of that, there's a movie that isn't even on our list from that year, which is Zodiac, which I actually I actually didn't really like either when that movie came out. And yeah, we can spoil. There's only five left.
Yeah.
That movie is now my favorite movie out of all of those movies that came out that year is Zodiac. Right.
All right.
So and anyways, that's for me. That's a lot of, like, obviously I'm doing things in jest here when I'm like sort of like,
yeah,
mocking the film and stuff. At the same time, it comes from a genuine place of like, you know, what was forced down. It was like, you must be this film, bro. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not.
No,
bro.
No.
Like, that's not my, yeah, what I'm into, you know?
Yeah. From film bro to Sam, what do you think of this movie?
I think what Mike was saying was interesting, because I mean, ultimately it lives in a space that it is very important to a lot of people. I mean, like, hearing about this movie, like, I've heard about it from a million people and they're all like, this is my favorite movie ever, this is my favorite movie ever, this is my favorite movie ever.
You can say guys when you say people, you know. Mm-hmm. No, I'm joking.
Wait, I'm so sorry, you keep cutting out. The movie really, it hits a lot of beats really well. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's like totally like a masterclass in suspension building. Yep. I think it's totally worthwhile to watch if you're interested in film and in just like seeing how something like this is made, because it hits those beats really, really well. And it doesn't, I don't think it misses any sort of beat that it's supposed to.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's very fair. And the thing is that, are you going to connect with it personally? Like, is it going to be your bag? Right. And is that a yay or a nay?
Yeah.
Right. And
from a filmmaking perspective,
it's unbelievable.
There's a reason why this is in our top 10. Yeah. It's a fantastic movie. Yeah. Like, truly. Yeah. Like, craftsmanship on another level. It just, does it appeal to your taste or not?
Yeah.
I think it's a really solid movie. I think it's, you know, talked about for a very good reason.
Yeah.
Hence why, I mean, the performances are great. Like you said, the building of the suspense, the tension is really great and really well done. I think the writing is pretty sharp, not the sharpest that the Coen brothers have ever been by any stretch of the imagination, but still well done. I think it's a good package altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And probably why it's our number six pick.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts before we sign off?
Watch movies, dude.
Watch movies. Watch movies. And yeah, Stay tuned to Outside the Frame. We'll be back next week with our early Oscar predictions. And we'll be back in a month with Sam for the last part of our top 25 films of the past 25 years. And I am so excited for that one.
Dude, this is why, like, it's so hard when Sam's not here, because, like, you know, she says, like, like Eternal Sunshine and Requiem for the Dream, she thought it was the same movie.
Yeah.
And that is totally genuine.
Oh,
she's
yeah,
not being facetious when she says that. She's not trying to be anything. And like that is Sam. Like that is so awesome, you know.
Sam, we love you.
that is just so awesome, dude. Yes. Like you don't understand how awesome I think that is, okay? And I'm being genuine when I say that. I'm not saying that as a joke. Like that is so awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, we appreciate you too and calling
That's
in,
me
as
saying
always,
that
Sam.
I appreciate you a lot,
yeah.
Sam.
Yeah,
I miss
we
you.
Really do.
Yeah. Miss
and,
you a ton.
And you will be back in a month, so thank you for all your hard work.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in to Outside the Frame. My name is Elijah.
I'm Mike.
I'm Sam.
And we will see you all next week. Take care of yourselves. Until then, see you, Sam.
Bye.